Me oh me, oh my oh my, I'm looking at the western sky.
It's the return of Western Skies, a monthly news and culture magazine that takes a look at issues facing Colorado and the West. This month, we're taking you on a tour and visiting sites that are uniquely Colorado. We'll travel the roads of southern Colorado.
This is definitely propane country out here.
Yeah.
A lot of propane tanks, propane filling stations.
Visit the boyhood home of a famous sports figure.
Dynamite comes in small packages.
And hear about an agricultural settlement that's all dried up.
And the people were poor and tired and weary, and so they gave up on the irrigation.
That's just a small taste of this edition of Western Skies. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Out here on the front range, looking for a good old time. Me and my friends are headed a little further on down. Me, oh me, oh my, oh my, I'm looking at the western sky.
Thanks for tuning in to Western Skies, a collaboration between the news department and the Big Something here at KRCC. I'm Andrea Chalfin. This month, we're taking you on a trip through Colorado, visiting places and talking to people that help make the Centennial State what it is. We don't have a roundtable for you this month. Instead, Big Something producers Noel Black and Craig Richardson took to the road this past July to meet some of our neighbors. This is their story.
Thursday, July 7th, 2011. These are the voyages of the Honda Odyssey. It's 3-day mission to, well, we're not exactly sure.
I'm Odysseus, and Noel is Barry.
Odysseus's lesser-known pal, Barry.
Odysseus and Barry, they traveled the roads in search of...
In a tradition that stretches from Homer to Kerouac, Craig Richardson and I recently traveled south from Colorado Springs on Highway 115 toward a journey of discovery, with no particular destination other than the road itself. Little did we know then that we'd soon meet a feline city administrator, a man who still typesets a weekly newspaper by hand, the caretaker of one of America's most amazing rest stops, and the great-great-grandson of one of the men who dug what is, arguably, Colorado's most fascinating ditch.
But for now, it's just us, the Honda Odyssey, a jar of milk, and various sundry expeditionary necessities as the roadside attractions sing their siren songs. Penrose, Colorado, the corner of Highway 115 and Fremont Street, sits the world's largest rocking chair.
America.
21 feet tall, 14 feet wide.
America.
9,100 pounds.
America.
Yeah, that's a dinosaur. Let's stop. That's a stegosaurus.
America.
Here on Highway 50, just outside of Canyon City, lies what appears to be a steel stegosaurus.
Oh, I wish I was deep in America tonight.
The inmates and employees of the State of Colorado Fremont Correctional Facility contributed 4,500 hours of labor to build the stegosaur.
By the time it dawns on us that Buckskin Joe's Park and Railway no longer exists near the Royal Gorge, it's already 7 p.m. We have no idea where we're going or where we're going to sleep. So we turn off Highway 50 onto Colorado 9 and drive north through the rolling hills on the backside of Pikes Peak.
The speedometer on the Honda Odyssey goes up to 160 miles per hour. Do you think we could get this thing going 160 miles an hour?
I don't think so. Not unless we were plummeting towards our deaths.
Like off America's mountain.
America.
Yeah. Though its population fluctuates between a mere 25 and 98 depending on the season, Guffey, Colorado would be difficult to miss even at dusk.
That would be because of the horse skeletons pulling a decrepit prison wagon with a man baby inside at the Ad Hoc Park across from the Guffey Garage on the main drag.
The park and the Guffey Garage, which serves now as a repository for animal skulls, pelts, auto parts sculptures, old clawfoot tubs, and myriad other items of dusty and rusty esoterica, belong to Bill Su, a Vietnam veteran with a white beard and ponytail who settled in Guffey almost 40 years ago and made it into a kind of breathing ghost town.
Coming here, there was six people in town, born and raised, and me. And I bought the general store. Next thing, I started buying all the land, you know. And bought the city hall, 73.
Sue drinks Milwaukee's best out of beer cozies fashioned from old tin cans of corn.
Hey, what's up? Did the fire go out?
Okay. Along with a park and the garage, he owns a group of small cabins and watches over the town's mayor, a black cat named Monster. He also started the town's infamous 4th of July chicken fly.
Well, you bring a chicken or rent a chicken from us, and you go up the chicken tower, and it's 12 feet tall, and you put the chicken in the chicken launch, which is a mailbox, all red velvet inside, sandpaper on the door, back's gone. Close the door, stick that chicken in that little red warm velvet box. I'll hand you your chicken plunger. And I'll say, how far? And you go, Colorado Springs. Pa-chow!
When we ask him if there's a place nearby to car camp, he points us toward his neighbor Cindy, who lives with a full-blooded wolf named Lakota. She offers us both a place to park out behind her cabin and front porch hospitality fit for the ancient Greeks.
A former prison guard and animal lover, Cindy's on the hunt for the person who recently killed a local family of foxes. After food and drink, she coaxes Lakota to howl for us using a barking hand puppet.
After that, she decided it was time to watch a movie about a serial killer.
Yeah, you got pretty freaked out.
Well, what with all the skeletons and wolves and...
Are you all right?
Get away!
After what was a pretty terrible night of snuggling in the back of the Honda Odyssey, we awoke to this sound.
On top of everything else, Bill Sue had a peacock.
Undaunted, we packed up early and set forth in directions south and west once again toward...
Victory!
Was the year the west was burning, I was on a mountain sleeping, I woke up dreaming about you.
In Salida, we pass a roadside memorial fashioned from the hull of a canoe and stop at a beautiful little pet cemetery filled with simple white wooden crosses with names like Lil Bit Williams, Gidget Scuffka,
Scooter Morrissey, Rusty Holt, Watson Clark, Tiffany Sanchez, Laddie Ermish, Coco Morrissey, Topsy Martin, Bitsy Clark.
From there, we made our way over to the San Luis Valley, where we stopped to admire a barbed wire fence along a dirt road where the posts were studded with sun-desiccated old shoes and boots.
In the northwest end of the valley, we stopped in the old-timey little town of Sawatch, from which time itself seems to have taken its leave.
An antique shop run by a transplanted New Yorker, a movie theater with the original post-war marquee, the post office and a bright yellow wood and brick facade with a hand-painted sign that reads Sawatch Crescent. These are the only businesses open along a colorfully painted three-block main street. Even when I first visited the Crescent over 15 years ago, it was, then, one of the only remaining handset linotype print shops and newspapers left in the U.S. Now, says Dean Combs, third-generation owner and publisher, it's one of two.
This machine, this linotype, was built in 1921. I wouldn't be surprised that it could be the oldest continuous-running linotype in the world, actually. It fundamentally makes a lid.
Piles of metal shavings from the machine gleam on the foot-worn planks.
Teeming stacks of old newspaper and invoices teeter atop every flat surface.
Water-stained wallpaper bubbles up beneath old calendars, newspaper clippings, and curling black and white photos.
Yet as Dean moves through the shop to explain these now arcane processes of newspaper printing, it's clear that beneath the seeming entropy lies the equally anachronistic logic of one who labors by himself and for the love of the work.
You know, you just go on one day after another. You can't miss a week because the Crescent is a publication of record. Even if I didn't have legal publications, I would still have to print. You can't miss your publication date. You can get glimmers of the end. You know, that day when it's really hard. And I'm not saying it's a misery. I'm just saying that sometimes you just feel that the end is somewhat coming. Not near. I wouldn't say it's near at all. I could be doing this 30 years from now, as far as it goes.
Technically, there are no articles in the Sawatch Crescent. only legal notices, event listings, and light items written by locals about the goings-on in the community.
And the content itself is just a matter of course where Dean's work is concerned.
Before long, the unending work calls, and he sits down to set type at the whirring hulk that sits in the front window.
Put the type into the forms.
Though clinical types might describe him as obsessive-compulsive, the pleasure he takes in his work at the linotype machine is palpable as he pecks at the keys and drops space bands into its chattering teeth.
The sheer fact of the paper's continued existence in the age of the internet when so many newspapers are disappearing is practically a miracle.
The real people went away. I'll find a better way. Someday.
Next stop, Shaw Creek Rest Area, east of Del Norte. Literally translated, that's east of from the north.
This is definitely propane country out here.
Yeah.
A lot of propane tanks, propane filling stations. A lot of people are off the grid out here.
Yes.
This is off-grid territory.
While a rest area is most often a convenient digression on the way to fairer destinations, today, it's our destination.
I stopped at this Colorado Department of Transportation rest stop briefly last year on my way to Ignacio and was taken aback not only by its near holy cleanliness, but by its myriad unexpected charms. It has a guest book, a fantastic tile mosaic of a deer, and handmade seasonal decorations. And all this while many other rest stops throughout the state have been shut down to save money. 4th of July decorations and plastic birds cover the sides of the restroom, and peach purple and white columbines explode in the flower beds that ring the rest stop when we arrive.
In a garage out back, we meet Nicole Friedrich, a Department of Transportation employee who's been taking care of this one rest stop for the past 8 years.
It was started about 10 years ago with a lady before me that was working here. She started it and we just picked it up. There's another guy, Tim Cruz, and the two of us, we just whatever comes across our fancy, we do, as long as it's not something that someone might find offensive. We try to please the public. Yeah.
Friedrich takes us into the restrooms to show us some of the things she's done. On the women's side, which was built of glazed yellow bricks, there are framed pictures of pressed flowers in each of the stalls. A plant hangs in the window. There are floral runner papers lining the ceiling throughout.
And in the men's bathroom, which is constructed of blue-green glazed bricks, there's a runner with cowboy cartoons in between horseshoes cut from felt.
We ask her why she does it, why she keeps the place so beautiful.
I think it's public appreciation. We also get a lot of support from our bosses. CDOT is very, very good to us, so it's the combination.
While awe is probably the last sentiment most rest stops inspire, it's clear from the comments in the guest book we're not the only ones who feel it.
Very nice and clean rest stop. Teresa, Calgary, Alberta, Canada. We appreciate the rest and beauty. Daryl, Holy Cross, Iowa. Very pretty. Larry and Ann, St. Louis, Missouri. Always nice here. Evans family.
Is moving so fast. I am unlimited. Everything is moving so fast.
We thank her and now turn eastward back across the San Luis Valley toward the Sangre de Cristo Mountains and the Grande Meats Outlet Store, home of Driveway Meat Poems.
Feeling low and kind of quirky? Make your day. Try elk jerky.
Time's getting tougher. Missing your mommy? Hey, feel good right now. Try elk salami.
As uplifted as we are by the jerky verse, as night nears, thoughts of another night snuggling in the back of the Odyssey turn our attention towards civilized accommodations. And lo, as we near the town of Monte Vista, what to our wondering eyes would appear?
Best Western Movie Manor Inn is an oasis of analog nostalgia in the desert of digital distractions.
Imagine in your mind's eye a two-story, crescent-shaped motel arising like a mirage along a vast stretch of empty highway.
Just to the east of it, two large drive-in movie theater screens stand stark and white like two blank billboards. We swindle the KRCC news director into buying us a room, check into the Charlton Heston suite, and watch a stray dog eat last night's popcorn from the parking lot. As soon as the sun sets, cars from the nearby town of Monta Vista will stream into the parking lot.
Meanwhile, guests at the movie Manor activate and adjust their in-room speaker boxes.
Pressing the button in 3, 2, 1.
Though there are two screens, there's only one movie viewable from the hotel rooms.
And tonight, it's Mr. Popper's Penguins.
Second-generation owner George Keloff grew up at this motel drive-in, which his parents built in 1955. Now in its 56th year, Keloff says that though the location is remote, it's been the perfect window for watching American culture change over the past half century.
It was crazy in the 50s and 60s, you know, drive-ins were called passion pits. And, you know, it was you know, you brought the date out, and it was, you know, a lot of times the movie didn't get watched. The windows got steamy, and, you know, and things were private out here in your own car. But really now we're more family-oriented. It's a mom and dad and the kids. We only play family fair movies, G, PG, and PG-13. We do not play R movies here. So we've kind of targeted more to families here.
Like Keloff's family, many in attendance tonight are second and third generation drive-in enthusiasts.
Clinton and Terry Phillips grew up in Monta Vista and have been coming to the movie Manor for more than 20 years.
Well, actually, tonight it's our anniversary, so that's why we're out here. But we just enjoy being kind of in your own environment and still being able to go out and watch a movie.
I think it's easier to come here just because you can bring your kids, obviously. And I just like the comfort of being in your own car and it's quiet. So if she starts crying, we don't have to worry about, you know, picking up and leaving.
Tom DeMaulin is from Denver. He and his family have been stopping here on their way to the Grand Canyon for the past 19 years.
This is always a good little rest stop on the way to the Grand Canyon for us, and we just love the kitsch. You know, there's nothing like it around. I don't think there's any drive-ins in Denver anymore.
Richard Appleton, DeMaulin's father-in-law, loves the remote setting.
My granddaughter and I just walked about a quarter mile out into the field, and there are no fences, no this, no that, and we were just out in nature, and to have the drive-in not in the middle of the city is a unique experience.
Craig and I settle down in the room with a bag of popcorn and a pair of refreshing beverages and relish the wonderful absurdity of watching a film through a window on a screen several hundred yards away with the darkened television mere feet from our faces.
Yeah, we did. You remember that?
One fine morning, I'm gonna ride out.
East to Monta Vista and on to Alamosa. From Alamosa, we turn south and head toward Antonito.
Yeah, one fine morning, I'm gonna ride out.
Old sod-roofed structures, a junkyard filled with nothing but rusty drums from concrete trucks like so many forsaken space capsules.
And just me and the skeleton crew.
In Antonito, we stop to admire the craftsmanship of Hano's Castle, a hand-built temple to Jesus fashioned largely from aluminum cans and soda bottles.
In a country kind of silent.
From Antonito, we drive through the searing heat of the barren high desert to the Rio Grande and on to San Luis, the oldest town in Colorado.
We're gonna ride out in a country silent.
In San Luis, we meet Joe Gallegos, the great-great-grandson of Dario Gallegos. Dario's name is the first listed on a placard next to the Long Canal founded in 1852 that helps irrigate 2,700 acres of this otherwise arid valley.
Known as the People's Ditch, this acequia, as it's called in Spanish, might look to the untrained eye like just that, a ditch, until you hear Gallegos describe its importance to the people of San Luis.
Therefore, the acequia or ditch, it's not quite just a ditch. It's a community ditch system that's operated by families mainly, and it's kind of more of an equitable way of distributing the land.
This style of irrigation requires that the plots of farmland be long, downward-sloping rectangles called extensiones that lie below the ditch so that the water can flow by gravity to as many plots as possible along its length. Gallegos draws it out in the dust on the hood of his truck.
That design came from Spain, which came from the Moors and when they were in Spain. So that's why we're so unique here, is that we're one of the few places in Colorado that have that long lot extension design. It's an old traditional way of laying out your land.
Perhaps most amazing is that all water allocation within the acequia is handled through an elected mayordomo, and all disputes are handled internally by those farmers and ranchers who use the acequia rather than in the court system.
Decreed water user, they're called parciantes here. So I'm a parciante. If I have an issue with somebody down the line or somebody up above the line, or we try to work it within the acequia, we'll have, say, somebody's being taking water out of turn or something, and he's not being cooperative with the ditch, we'll have two people go and talk to him as neighbors and friends and try to settle the problem. We really hate doing anything the legal system way. It doesn't seem to work very well, and plus it costs a lot of problems and enemies. But we have methods of doing stuff that that are much different than...
Gallegos invites us back to his historic farm and ranch to see his crops and offers us a large bunch of radishes from a weedy row.
If you don't have weeds, you're not organic, man.
Gallegos is worried that state water laws may one day override the traditions of the acequias and their communities, but in the meantime, he hopes that education and respect for the importance of the acequia tradition will continue to connect the people and families of San Luis.
The sacred medium. That's what keeps us together, is that sacred medium right there. And in a high-altitude desert, as we are, where we're getting less than 9 inches of precipitation, drought conditions right now, we really appreciate water. So you have to understand that, too. You know, it's very sacred around here. It doesn't look like it's a desert, but the acequias have kept it this way because we distribute the water.
It's never easy to say goodbye. To the faces.
Though our odyssey through Southern Colorado was only 3 days long, we met some amazing people.
It was refreshing to know that there are still places where people have managed to keep their local identities and traditions alive.
It was a good trip.
Yeah, it was a good trip.
I asked the room if I'd said enough. No one really answered. They just said, don't go, don't go, don't go, don't go, don't go. Well, all this leaving is never ending.
That piece was produced by Noel Black and Craig Richardson. For a collection of images from their journey, head on over to krcc.org. We'll be right back with more Western Skies.
Thank you. looking at the western sky.
Welcome back to Western Skies. I'm Andrea Chalfin. Most people probably don't think of Colorado as a major cave state, but with over 1,000 natural caves, Colorado is a caving paradise. Last month, the National Speleological Society held their annual convention close to Glenwood Caverns in Glenwood Springs, and cave conservation was a major focus. From Glenwood Caverns, Shelley Schlender reports.
It's a hot, sunny day in Glenwood Springs as two dozen tourists prepare to enter Glenwood Caverns, while a tour guide named Larissa Crisson gives them all a special offer.
So because we're not allowed to touch anything inside, we have here outside some formations. And the name of these formations are cave popcorn, and you can touch it if you want before we go in. So go ahead,
touch it.
Take it out of the system.
They do, then Crisson opens a big door on the mountain face. Cavers file into a rocky tunnel, and she shuts the door, and suddenly they're in a darker, cooler, damper world that makes the hot, bright Colorado day seem far away. Soon that cave-like dampness will grow stronger still, because Larissa's leading them another 50 feet down the tunnel and through yet another door.
To keep the water inside, that's why we have so many doors.
High humidity helps a cave stay healthy and filled with glistening rocks. Some look like giant strips of bacon, giant soda straws, and popcorn. Hidden in some caves are strange creatures such as blind spiders and microbes that live in such dark and severe conditions. They're known as extremophiles. CU Boulder cave scientist Fred Louiser says even space scientists are interested in life underground.
If they find life on other moons and other planets, life will probably be very similar to what we're finding in caves.
Deep down in Glenwood Caverns, scientists have discovered microbes that show promise as cancer fighters. But some cave life can be deadly. A sulfur cave in Steamboat Springs is home to rare, gooey, dangling, poisonous microbes. They look like mucus, which is why their scientific name is, well, it's snottites. Snottites thrive on sulfur fumes, then ooze battery acid. So that cave in Steamboat Springs is a hazard for the occasional amateur who ignores warning signs and ventures in.
You pass out immediately, and if you stayed in that environment for probably, I'm guessing, more than an hour or two, it would kill you.
So far, rescuers have saved the handful of people who have fainted in that sulfur cave. Not all cave dwellers are microbial. In Glenwood Caverns, scientists recently discovered a tiny, red, blind pseudoscorpion. Bears love caves, and so do bats. In fact, Mark Maslin, a Colorado geologist and caving expert, says cavers must be careful not to disturb bat colonies.
Bats are hibernating creatures, and if you wake them up during the wintertime, which is easy to do with lights and noise and things like that, then they go outside and their food source, insects, is not available to them and they die off.
Caves with large bat colonies are closed to the public for another reason. A mysterious, deadly disease called white nose syndrome has killed over 400,000 bats in the U.S. So far, the disease is concentrated in the northeastern U.S., but since its discovery in 2006, it's infected many bat colonies. To reduce its spread, wildlife experts have asked cavers to avoid caves that might shelter any bats. Some scientists, like Mark Maslin, are trained to keep their gear clean of white nose syndrome, and they're permitted to go off the beaten path. At Cave of the Winds in Colorado Springs, he wears boots and a caving helmet and strides past the tourists.
Where's my mummy? Don't go down there.
He enters a hidden cave that he helped discover.
This is not on the normal commercial tour.
With a headlamp as his only light, Maslin unseals an environmental door to reveal what he calls an easy entrance tunnel, 18 inches wide, the size of a dinner platter.
That's the tightest we're doing today.
He invites me to crawl in.
Put your arms ahead of you, arms ahead of you.
Oh. The reward for squeezing through is a muddy cave with a dazzling, spiky crystal flower that's taller than a man.
It's a beaded anthodite bush.
In years past, Maslin says that cavers used to carry anthodites away. To protect those kinds of treasures, Maslin follows the motto of today's modern cave enthusiasts. Take nothing but pictures. Leave nothing but footprints. Kill nothing but time. Back at Glenwood Caverns, the tourists are enjoying taking their time as their tour guide, Larissa Crisson, has them look high overhead at the stalactites. Thanks to all the doors that seal in that cool, damp humidity, those stalactites are covered with what has made them slowly grow over eons of time. It's water drops.
If you're gonna be hit by a water droplet like that one, we call that the fairy kisses or the cave kisses. And you're gonna be lucky for the rest of the day.
And thanks to conservation efforts from fans that love these caves, perhaps future generations will also enjoy the wonders of caves and discovery, and if they're lucky, fairy kisses. For KRCC News, I'm Shelley Schlender in Glenwood Springs.
If you're interested in seeing some Colorado caving photos, head on over to krcc.org. The small town of Manassa sits south of Alamosa along Highway 142. Manassa is surrounded by farms and ranches, but in town is a museum dedicated to the Manassa Mauler. One-time heavyweight boxing champion Jack Dempsey was born there, and KRCC's Daniel Edwards made the trip to Dempsey's birthplace to find out a little more about the man's life and legacy.
My name is Michelle Richardson. I am the curator of the Jack Dempsey Museum in Manassa, Colorado. The building that we are in that houses the museum is his boyhood home. He was born here in Manassa June 24, 1895. He was the ninth of 11 children. We get so many people from all over the world, and they all know about Jack Dempsey. From the very, very young, I had three little boys from New Jersey that put me to shame. I thought, I'm just going to go home and you guys can take over, because they knew everything about him. By the time he was 24, he was the world heavyweight champion. He fought Jess Willard July 4th, 1919 in Toledo. Jess Willard was a huge man. He stood 6'7" and weighed 250 pounds. Compared to Dempsey's 6'187". But, dynamite comes in small packages. The picture of the Willard fight, the reason it means so much to me, or the reason I like it so much, is the odds are against him. You kind of see the David and the Goliath here. But the reason I like this picture is it says to me, if you want it bad enough, you've got to reach. And that's my message. A lot of our Colorado people will know Damon Runyon. He was a Pueblo newspaper reporter. He is the man that gave Jack Dempsey the name the Manassa Mauler. He was watching Dempsey spar one night, and he says, man, Dempsey just mauls his opponents. He's Jack Dempsey the Manassa Mauler, and it stuck. And Dempsey looked for Damon at all of his fights, and he was never disappointed. We've got the Firpo fight where Dempsey was knocked out of the ring. He hit the back of his head on the typewriter. Thought he had lost the fight, and the newspaper reporters on the front row pushed him back in. And he said in his book, and I'll quote, I had eight Firpos coming at me. All I could do is swing and hope that I hit one. He hit Firpo and knocked him out, but didn't realize it until the next day because he had suffered a concussion. He had a restaurant on 1619 Broadway in New York that he opened up after he had lost the title. Quite a place. He would stand and greet people, and it was a nice place to be. He had always mentioned, if you're from Manassa and you come to New York, you can eat at my place for free. And some of the people, I'm told, from here in town put him to the test, and they said, we're from Manassa, and they got their meal free. So true to his word. This is his Hollywood wall, and because of his second wife, Estelle Taylor, he did do movies. He didn't like doing movies. He didn't like everything that was prior to being filmed. But he did enjoy his Hollywood friends. And of course, he was a part of the Lambs, who are some of the Hollywood elite. You see him here with Rudolph Valentino, with Jimmy Durante, with Pat Boone, Hugh O'Brien, Carol Channing, Beverly Sills. And then we come to this wall. You see him with Babe Ruth, and down here with Joe DiMaggio and Dizzy Dean, Elroy Hirsch. The funny thing about Dempsey is he was so humble that he wanted to know these people and was always a little surprised when they were just as anxious to get to know him. He was inducted into the Colorado Sports Hall of Fame. He was inducted with Dutch Clark from Pueblo and Byron White. He passed away May 31st, 1983 at 87 years, 11 months. So I'll give him 88. He had full use of his mental faculties. He wasn't punch drunk or shaky or anything like that. He just had a weak heart. He's buried on Long Island, and his gravestone says it all about him. It says he was a gentleman and a gentleman, and I can vouch for that. Always very, very kind.
That audio postcard was produced by KRCC's Daniel Edwards. There's a slideshow of images from the museum online at krcc.org. Just click on Western Skies. Canyon City is well known for playing a role in the state's prison system, with one-third of the Department of Corrections' public facilities, including the first. It makes sense, then, that the town is also home to the Museum of Colorado Prisons.
Hello. How are you guys doing? Welcome to prison.
Hey.
This building is the original women's prison. It was used from 35 to 68. Next door over here you saw is Colorado.
To walk through the halls is to walk through time. Open cell doors lead to exhibits portraying everything from former wardens, uniforms, prisoners, and even contraband art fashioned from toilet paper. While free with admission audio tours are available to visitors, museum office manager Nancy Larson took me down the prison hallway.
Most of our cells that we have here have exhibits of the Colorado Penitentiary System from 1868 until the mid-1980s. This first cell here that we have is, we call it the Edna cell, but technically it's just information on some famous or infamous, however you want to look at it, women inmates. Edna herself.
In every state, prisons are a big thing. They're not usually things that people want to talk about too much, but they affect a lot of different lives, and they go through a lot of changes.
That's Kay Ellison, the director of the Museum of Colorado Prisons. Ellison herself is a former Department of Corrections employee, and the changes she's referring to include a progression to larger cell sizes and the amount of electricity and heating in cells. While the museum documents serious topics like prison gang history and methods of controlling prisoners, there's also recognition of other aspects of prison life. Again, Larson.
You'll see this chess set was made out of toilet paper, but it was contraband because he made it in his cell and not during a place during arts and crafts, so it was confiscated from him. And it's made with toilet paper, and it was glued together with toothpaste.
Of course, there's also a section on contraband weapons, and a former gas chamber sits in the front yard.
If people like to go look at that, I just request that you don't sit in the chair. Kids will try. Let me tell you, kids have tried.
And why do you not want them to sit in the chair?
Because it's not very stable. And why would you want to?
Well, you know, which is an interesting point, which is, what is it about this museum, whereas it's not necessarily... I mean, on the one hand, it's a celebration of the prison industry.
Industry, yes, ma'am.
But on the other hand, you know, you think about things like the gas chamber, and you know, in the some of the historical pieces.
People want to know about that stuff because they don't get it in our media today. We have become a destination museum, not only here in the United States, but from Europe also.
Director Ellison says the museum is one of only a handful of prison museums in the country that's housed in a former prison. Not only that, but...
We're the only one that shares a wall with an active prison. Just on the other side of the wall here in our yard, there's Territorial Correctional Center.
That's the state's oldest facility and currently a medium-security men's prison. The actual location of the museum is a point of pride for people like Larson and Ellison. And Ellison says documenting the history of the Colorado prison system isn't just a piece of state history.
Canyon City grew up around the prison system. See, the old Territorial Prison was built in 1871, and there were not very many people in Canyon City at that time. So as the prisons expanded, the city expanded. And so it's important not only for the history of the Department of Corrections, but it's important for the history of the city of Canyon City.
The Department of Corrections still owns the former women's prison that houses the museum. They lease it to the city of Canyon City, which in turn leases it to the nonprofit museum. They regularly host events that highlight the history of the prison system and Canyon City. We'll be right back with more Western Skies, where we'll visit with the wolves and head to the dry.
Western Sky.
Welcome back to Western Skies, where we're talking to people and visiting places that are uniquely Colorado. I'm Andrea Chalfin. Up in the hills, southeast of Westcliff, is a place called Mission Wolf. Three dozen wolves and wolf-dog mixes live at this remote sanctuary, rescued from death when their previous owners could no longer care for them. KRCC's Shauna Lewis brings us the story about the wolf sanctuary that's also become a refuge for humans.
A long, rutted dirt road climbs a steep hill and ends at a collection of tents, teepees, and odd rustic buildings, including one sort of shaped like a wolf's head. But you know you really arrived at Mission Wolf at sunset. Howls echo through aspens and pines as the sky turns to gold behind the rugged Sangre de Cristo Mountains. It's part of the Mission Wolf magic that entices some 7,000 people a year to brave miles of bumpy dirt road to get to this place, far from fast food chains, continuous electricity, and reliable cell phone service. This is where humans get the rare chance to look directly into the amber eyes of a wolf. That experience makes many visitors feel the same way as 12-year-old Ross Margolis of Niwot, Colorado.
I never thought I'd ever even see a wolf in real life, besides in a zoo. And I really am happy I've actually gotten to touch a wolf, like pet one. And that was really amazing.
It all started 24 years ago when Mission Wolf director Kent Weber took in a few wolf dogs that were too wild for their owners to manage. It wasn't long before the first full-blooded wolf came to them. After that, the calls didn't stop.
We took in 52 wolves before we learned to say no. And now we've turned down, you know, thousands, literally, you know, 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 people that have had a pet wolf and they can't keep it. A zoo that had extra wolves and they didn't have room.
Becoming a tourist attraction and a place for people to get in touch with nature was not what Weber had in mind when he brought the first wolves out here. Initially, he says, they tried to hide, but it didn't work. The media found them. Mission Wolf landed in the pages of publications like National Geographic and Parade. Now visitors of all ages come from around the globe. 23-year-old Cynthia Giargueux of Montreal and a friend are volunteering at Mission Wolf. They found out about it the 21st century way.
I was on YouTube and I saw a thing about wolves, so I click on it and it was from Mission Wolf. And then I said, oh, that's interesting. So I watched other Mission Wolf and then I realized that Mission Wolf was something and not just one video on YouTube. And I went to see on Google and I found the sanctuary and I just thought, like, I want to be there.
The two French-Canadian women quit their jobs in Montreal, bought a car, and drove to Colorado. That is, after they learned to drive first. Now they're part of the Mission Wolf volunteer staff for the next 6 months, and sharing a tent while fixing up one of the refuge's teepees. Whether people come for a few hours or a few weeks, if they want to help out, there's work for them to do. It could be anything, from clearing thistles or stacking firewood, to building fences or butchering a dead horse to feed the wolves. Michael Leiden of Stamford, Connecticut, has been volunteering at Mission Wolf on and off for a couple of years. He's got two buckets of mule meat and a bunch of kids ready to feed some wolves.
I have gloves. All you need is one for your throwing hand. The object is get the meat over the fence as quickly and as orderly as possible. We don't want things falling outside the fence. And we're feeding two wolves, so we want the meat to go into at least two different piles. We don't want everything in one place because then they'll start fighting over it.
Each year, Weber takes a few ambassador wolves on the road for a month or two to visit schools and groups across the country. They've been to the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C., and even once appeared on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Weber says that getting face-to-face with a wolf is transformative for people. But there's more to it than that.
When people get a chance to touch the wolf and actually help build the enclosure and cut up the raw meat that it takes to take care of wolves, they soon get over the idea that it's not really romantic to have wolves in cages, which a lot of people think it is. It's nothing more than we're jailers to wild animals. We'd love nothing more than to turn them loose, but we know if we did, these wolves don't know how to survive. They just end up dead, and they'd cause a nuisance for wild wolves.
Along with helping to take care of the wolves, Weber encourages volunteers to build and fix things around the sanctuary. He has a knack for making carpenters out of city folks who've never held a hammer, much less a drill, before.
People love to improve their daily life. And when people don't know how to build something or just do anything other than spend money to improve their daily life, when they run out of money, they get very frustrated and don't know what to do. So Mission Wolf is, I call myself a shop teacher more than a wolf teacher.
Weber says he enjoys working with people as much as he does with wolves. But the number of volunteers that show up is growing every year.
we had so many qualified people wanting to help us that our biggest challenge is how do you manage all these people that want to help?
During the past 24 years, Mission Wolf has become more than a refuge for wolves and humans. The motto is education versus extinction. They teach people not to be afraid of wolves, but that wolves don't make good pets. They also teach people about the crucial role that wild wolves play in a healthy ecosystem. Weber says they'll have done their job right when places like Mission Wolf are obsolete. For KRCC News, I'm Shauna Lewis in Westcliff.
There's a slideshow of Mission Wolf online at krcc.org. Just click on Western Skies.
Me, oh my, I'm looking at the western skies.
And finally today, despite the fertility of the Arkansas River Valley, not every seed will grow. Such was the case with the African-American homesteaders who settled the Dry, which was abandoned due to irrigation issues. KRCC's Kate Januska reports on a recent archaeological dig that's attempting to bring the Dry's history back into the light.
Remember when Mother saw the land, she said she was really devastated because in Oklahoma it was green and there were streams and there were trees. And she said when they came up from the ditch and over the hill and looked across, she could see for 100 miles and there was nothing, just dry nothing.
Alice Craig McDonald describes her mother's first reaction to the Dry, a community near Manzanola built by African-American homesteaders. The inhospitable land eventually drove settlers away, but archaeologists are now examining the abandoned Dry in hopes of dusting off a piece of Colorado and American history.
The Dry is part of the Western movement of settlers, and people tend to think about settling in the West as something that white populations did.
That's Dr. Doris Cruz. She's a project leader and assistant professor of archaeology at the University of Denver, which along with the State Historical Fund is backing the dig. She says the first homesteaders arrived in 1915 and slowly trickled away until the 1960s and 70s. The site is relatively young in archaeological terms, but dig co-leader Michelle Slaughter of Avalon Archaeology says its youth is a bonus.
We have these wonderful sites with features and artifacts and that type of thing, but we also have the opportunity to speak with people who lived there and whose families were there.
Those families included Alice Craig McDonald and her cousin Bobby Craig. He remembers the Dry as the best time of his life before his family moved to La Junta so his dad could work for the Santa Fe Railroad.
It was a feeling of separation because the Dry was home to me. I mean, we couldn't wait to get to the Dry. Each weekend we would return and help with the chores and do things.
That included hauling water from about 10 miles away, water for both cattle and humans, using wagons and later pickups, sometimes twice a day. There was absolutely no water on site. In 1915, McDonald says 160 acres of land in the area could be homesteaded for about $4. That land was too far from rivers to divert water and too high above the water table for reliable wells. In order to survive, homesteaders needed an irrigation system. Alice says a dam and ditches were built, but a landmark flood destroyed the system in 1921.
And that was the end of the irrigating system. And the people were poor and tired and weary, and so they gave up on the irrigation.
The Dry's residents evaporated too, but Slaughter says what remains on the site now is still of great value.
You have a long span where people were living out there from the teens up until the 70s. So you have these much older artifacts mingled with things from the 70s. And it's unusual. You don't come across a lot of sites like that.
She and Cruz are focusing on the Dry's domestic areas, hoping to flesh out the social history of Dry residents, says Slaughter.
Dishes and glass and, you know, bits of farming equipment and hardware from inside the homes. All kinds of things.
Canning jars.
Lots of canning jars.
A couple of toy things. Like we had a leg in the hand of a small doll and a star from Roy Rogers.
A little sheriff's badge.
Sheriff's star.
Just being able to see for miles and miles. And you definitely got a sense of what some of those first settlers must have felt when they came out there and knew that they had quite the task ahead of them.
Jessica Unger is a grad student from Brown University working on the dig. Unger says she was drawn toward archaeology, and this project in particular, because it's sites like these that can tell the diverse stories of oft-overlooked, everyday people.
And especially at a place like the Dry, it's interesting because, as alluded to before, it's something that's kind of been forgotten in a lot of the historical memory. So I think that archaeology is a really useful tool for understanding this really important part of American history that too often is easily forgotten.
Archaeologist Cruz says community education and involvement are also large components of the project.
Because part of the project deals with the public archaeology, it's actually to establish a relationship with the community, the local community at large, but also the descendant community. So part of it is going to be to make this information accessible for the general audience.
The project has hosted several public events in the Rocky Ford and La Junta areas to help revive the memory of the Dry. Researchers are also planning more digs and events in the next few years. Archaeologists Slaughter and Cruz both say the experience has its moments of poignancy.
They all had trees when the place was inhabited, but there's only one living standing tree today.
So we actually made the tree kind of the symbol of our sites and excavations because they were so important and so central for the life of the settlers.
Bobby Craig agrees that the symbol of the one surviving tree is apt. From its dusty soil, the Dry created a legacy of pioneer spirit, as well as a new generation infused with that same pioneer determination.
All the children that were raised there obtained a college degree, and that's pretty unique for the situations that they were in.
Researchers plan to one day publish both scholarly and public accounts of their current and ongoing work at the Dry. For KRCC News, I'm Kate Januska.
You can see historical photos from the Dry, revisit any of these stories, and see their respective slideshows by heading on over to krcc.org.
Me, oh me, oh my, oh my, I'm looking at the western sky.
Thanks for joining us this month for Western Skies. We'll see you again next month. We want to hear from you. What's on your mind? Send us an email at westernskies@krcc.org or give us a call at 719-434-3657. Western Skies is a production of KRCC News and The Big Something with producers Andrea Chalfin, Noel Black, and Craig Richardson. Special thanks to the Haunted Wind Chimes for our theme music with lyrics and arrangement by Anea Lujan. The Haunted Wind Chimes are Shayla Lujan, Mike Clark, Desiree Garcia, Sean Fanning, and Anea Lujan. For KRCC News and Western Skies, I'm Andrea Chalfin.